I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
It was super hot all day because almost the whole time we were climbing at the top of the clouds, and so we got that convection, and it was nuclear hot. And as a result, we had a little more rockfall than we would have liked.
Sounds from Mount Everest, which is seeing the biggest gridlock in memory. 300 climbers, Sherpas, guides lined up along the ropes attempting to summit. One Sherpa saying, "This is the first time I've ever seen it like this." We have video at hereandnow.org of what looks like a line of ants crossing the mountain, a backlog that's made this one of the deadliest climbing seasons since the notorious 1996 Into Thin Air year, when 15 people lost their lives. So far this month, 11 people are said to have died on the world's tallest mountain. That includes deaths on the North Slope in China. We want to start here today with Grayson Schaefer, senior editor at Outside Magazine, who's at base camp on Everest. Grayson, why is this backlog happening?
Well, I think, you know, this year you have a sort of perfect storm of weather where the climbing season ended up being pushed back later into the season. The summit windows are happening later in the season than they normally do, and you have more climbers than you normally do. So you basically have a larger number of people trying to fit into a smaller number of weather windows where the jet stream is not right over the summit of the mountain, so the winds are calm enough and the weather is nice enough for people to make summit bids. There are so many people that you end up with these traffic jams where people are waiting, you know, up to 3.5 hours, I've heard from one guide, you know, trying to use these fixed lines to get up the mountain.
Well, and they're climbing later in the day than they normally would. And we understand some are total novices who have to be shown how to put on crampons. And you wrote about a Turkish New Yorker who arrived wanting to bring his bike up to the summit. Now, this comes as a surprise to people who think you have to qualify to climb Mount Everest. You have to summit, you know, other things, and you have to get a permit to go up.
You do have to get a permit. But, yeah, I mean, the idea that there's some sort of, you know, resume that you absolutely need to build is sort of a misnomer. You know, most of the reputable Western outfitters will want you to have climbed, you know, some tall mountain on another continent like Denali or Aconcagua. But in recent years, there are a lot of local outfitters and some Western outfitters that really will allow anybody to climb if they've got the cash to do it. It can be done. It's just that, you know, when things go wrong, people who don't have experience have very little to fall back on, you know, when they're in trouble, and that's where the problems begin.
Since there are so many people trying to summit, what does that feel like in base camp? What does that feel like in the mountain? I mean, it's glorious, we know, to be there, but what else does it feel like because of this incredible moment?
Well, I think, you know, there's definitely a bit of tension in camp. You know, people need to work together, but at the same time, if one team waits through a nice summer window while another team, you know, or another dozen teams climb, the teams that wait end up potentially missing their summit window. So there's a little bit of tension, there's a little bit of competition, I think, but mostly I get the sense that the guides and the outfitters want to work together, because if they work together, they get more people to the top safely and have fewer of these unfortunate tragedies.
Well, is there anger, I'm wondering, at these people who are attempting to summit and may not know what they're doing? I mean, the guy with the bike went up without his Sherpa and without his bike. He made it to the summit, but on the way back, he had to be rescued by his Israeli teammate, who gave up his summit bid in order to rescue the Turkish New Yorker to bring him back down. By the way, we have some photos, thanks to you, at our website. But is there any anger, you know, from the really experienced climbers at these people who don't really know what they're doing?
The anger and the resentment tends to sort of be indirect and, you know, sort of at night in camp, you know, especially when these climbers get into trouble. It's incumbent upon the experienced climbers to rescue them. You know, even if they want to go for their summit bids, the sort of general ethic in climbing is that you have to stop and help someone if you can offer some assistance. And, you know, in past years, we've seen controversies and scandals emerge when climbers have been foundering and it turns out, you know, have later died, and whole teams of people have walked past them and done nothing to help.
Well, but then there was the Canadian woman who died last weekend. Her fellow climbers urged her to turn around. She seemed to be in trouble. She couldn't even speak anymore, but she signaled that she wanted, you know, aggressively that she wanted to keep going. She did summit, but on the way down, she ran out of oxygen. She had gone through, I think you reported, something like 9 canisters of oxygen, you know, collapsed and died. people are calling for banning that supplemental oxygen or getting rid of the professional guides so that the mountain returns to the seasoned climber. Do you think those calls are now going to gain momentum?
You know, there are incidents, if not at this scale, there are incidents like this every year, and there are those same calls every year. And, you know, I think in general, it's a tough call because there are certainly reputable outfitters who screen their clients very carefully and who climb the mountain and guide the mountain safely every year. And then there are some fly-by-night outfitters that routinely have problems. You know, the ironic thing is that the more people die, the more people want to climb it. And the amount of money that we're talking about here, anywhere from $50,000 to $75,000 to $80,000 to climb with a Western outfitter, there's so much money on the table that it would be very unlikely for the Nepalese government to curtail the number of people climbing.
Yeah. And so, Grayson Schaefer, the problem this year is this window of opportunity, everybody rushing to try their summit in this window of opportunity. You say there's another one coming up?
Yeah, there's another one right now. And in fact, we just got off the radio with one of the teams with Dave Hahn, who's another one of our outside riders, who's summited 13 times. He's at the South Col right now with his team, and he believes that maybe between 80 and 120 people are going to try and summit tonight. And he and his base camp manager were on the radio trying to sort of game out their strategy for how to avoid the crowds and make a safe summit bid and get back down to Camp 4 at about 26,000 feet tomorrow afternoon, if they're lucky, hopefully.
Unbelievable. With all the things you have to think about in climbing, now crowd control. Grayson Schaefer, senior editor at Outside Magazine at base camp of Mount Everest with a huge gridlock going on there. Grayson, thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay.
President Obama used his commencement address at the U.S. Air Force Academy yesterday to push back on Republican claims that he leads from behind. The president told the Air Force class of 2012 that there is new confidence in American leadership.
Around the world, the United States is leading once more. From Europe to Asia, our alliances are stronger than ever. Our ties with the Americas are deeper. We're setting the agenda in the region that will shape our long-term security and prosperity like no other, the Asia-Pacific.
The president has focused on the Asia-Pacific region, which includes everything from Pakistan to China and North Korea. But our next guest says in the Middle East, America's and Obama's leadership has been in some aspects a striking policy failure. Further, Fawaz Jirjis says America's ability to dictate policy in the Middle East has diminished, that we are witnessing America's moment there coming to an end. That's pretty damning stuff. And we want to spend a few minutes today with Fawaz Jirjis, chair of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics. His new book is Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment. And he joins us from the studios of WNYC in New York. Fawaz Jirjis, always good to talk to you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
But as I said, pretty damning stuff. So if you wouldn't mind, let's just start. Brief laundry list. Just tick off briefly. I mean, it's half the book. But tick off briefly what you see as President Obama's failures in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, Obama's greatest political failure has been his inability to deliver a Palestinian-Israeli peace process because he made it a strategic priority of his administration. On the first day in his White House, the first telephone call he made was to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, in which he promised to deliver, to broker a peace settlement between Palestinians and Israelis. He also, and this is a very important point, he also said that a Palestinian-Israeli peace treaty serves America's vital strategic interests in the Middle East itself.
And instead, we saw the Palestinians turn to the UN for their two-state bid. So obviously, failure there.
It's a very, very important failure because this is really, Robin, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is one of the most important fundamental fault lines in the region, not just between Jews and Palestinians or Jews and Arabs, but also between Arabs and Muslims on the one hand and the United States. They view the United States really as deeply involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict.
But continue
also,
your list. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. President Barack Obama, as you know, an inspirational leader. When he came to office, he gave a series of speeches in Ankara, Turkey, in Cairo, Egypt, in Jakarta, Indonesia, in which he really made major pledges about a new beginning with the Muslim world, about changing American foreign policy, about basically an enlightened foreign policy that takes into account the aspirations and the dreams and the fears and the hopes of the people. The reality is there is a big divide between the rousing rhetoric of Barack Obama and the actual policies. And here, Robin, is a very, very important point. One of the major points I make in the book is that, contrary to what his right-wing critics claim, Barack Obama is deeply anchored in the consensus in the American narrative on foreign policy, that he is far from being liberal or even leftist. He basically subscribes to the dominant views on American foreign policy. He is a realist. His model of his foreign policy is Bush Sr. and JFK. He has always stressed that he was a realist as opposed to being a liberal or a preacher or a sermonizer or a democracy promotion president. Mm-hmm. And this, what this tells us, the reason why you cannot discuss the Barack Obama foreign policy without discussing what I call the bitter inheritance, the bitter legacy between the United States and that part of the world. He inherited a severe challenges, and what he has been trying to do is gradually address some of the questions, as opposed to a transformational foreign policy that challenges the dysfunctional American political system. Barack Obama has not tried to change American foreign policy. He is a centrist president in the same spirit of most American presidents.
Well, one of the things he inherited over decades, as you say, is that it's been for decades the American policy to prop up dictators in the Middle East, because the feeling was that at least those dictators were preventing uprisings and terrorists from unsettling the region. You say that was the thinking, which is why, as you and others point out, the U.S. was late in getting on board the Arab Spring. But then when the Obama administration did, it was for some countries, against the Arab Spring and others. But Fawaz, it's just as you lay out your thoughts before we come to the break, and we'll pick them up on the other side, you yourself say that President Obama inherited what you call a poisonous legacy of the Bush administration, you know, one that tried to impose democracy. Isn't, in fact, the Obama administration, in moving away from that, maybe not appeasing you or others who would want him to do more, but isn't he moving away from what you said was a poisonous legacy?
Absolutely. And in many ways, from day one, President Barack Obama and his foreign policy team made it very clear they want a clean break with the neoconservative legacy, the multiple wars on multiple fronts, the hundreds of thousands of American forces battling in Muslim lands. America's moral credibility suffered a great deal. He also wanted to get rid of the so-called democracy promotion and return American foreign policy to the days before it was hijacked by the neoconservatives.
Fawaz Jurjis of the London School of Economics, his new book, Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment, in which he lays out what he says is a largely failed foreign policy in the Middle East from the Obama administration. And Professor Jurjis, Fawaz, you were just saying, in answer to my question, you know, isn't it something that the administration said they wanted to do, move away from the Bush administration, which was imposing or attempting to impose democracy on the Middle East, as you write, that failed and weakened the U.S. in every way. You know, the Obama administration had pledged to move away from that.
Absolutely. Move away from the social engineering project of trying to plant Jeffersonian seeds of democracy from the top down using American forces, trying to reduce American boots on the ground in Muslim lands, shifting the debate from the poisonous foreign policy to other issues. Absolutely correct. And he is what he has not done, Robert, and this is not a book about, really, it's not just about the Obama presidency. You cannot discuss the Obama presidency in isolation of American foreign policy and what I call the dysfunctional American political system. That is, what I mean by the dysfunctional American political system, which includes special interest groups, it includes the Congress, it includes a consensus on American foreign policy that basically does not really address the serious challenges facing that part of the world and America's challenges in that part of the world. So what Barack Obama, while he is absolutely correct to move away from the neoconservative strategy and legacy, he has not really invested adequate political capital in trying to capitalize on the inspirational moment. He has not really invested capital in trying to bridge the divide between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which is the most fundamental fault lines. You might say, why? Why not? Because he does not want to challenge basically the dysfunctional American political system. That would have been costly to his presidency. And that's why I started by saying that, contrary to what right-wing critics would like us to believe, Barack Obama is a mainstream president. He has not really attempted to radically change American foreign policy. And also, as you suggested, Robin, what we need to understand about this particular presidency, it's not just only view the Middle East through the dominant lens of American foreign policy. The Middle East is not important for this presidency. This is a Pacific region president. This is a presidency that believes America's future lies in the Pacific region and Asia, not in the Middle East. The Middle East is not important for this presidency, and that's why, when it came to investing serious political capital, Barack Obama has shied away from basically making the investment. And finally, on this particular point, is that Barack Obama, in a way, it's not just, but it's wrong to say that this is a failed policy. In fact, I go out of my way in the book to say that his foreign policy is a mixed bag. His greatest political achievement has been to pull out American forces from Muslim lands. His most important political achievement has been to indirectly shift the debate in the Muslim world from the poisonous foreign policy to questions of empowerment, institution building, dignity, and development. He has used his own personal story in a very effective way initially, but the reality is he has not invested serious political capital to begin the process of challenging the dysfunctional American political system and basically change the lens through which the system itself views that part of the world.
Well, a couple of thoughts. Some might say, after watching especially the Arab Spring, that maybe parts of the Middle East would do better if the U.S. did do less, you know, as countries took it upon themselves to liberate themselves. But then there's also this thought of it, you know, that it's intractable. And you mentioned that the president seems to be interested in other areas. Well, there are people who are applauding that. Here's Leon Hader of the Cato Institute, a libertarian. Obama not only recognizes that the U.S. is constrained in its ability to determine outcomes in the Middle East, he also understands that the continuing U.S. preoccupation with the region doesn't allow Washington to invest the time and resources in maintaining its position in East Asia, where core interests are at stake.
Robin, the beginning of the end of America's moment, I mean the subtitle of my book, mm-hmm. It's the beginning of America's dominance that has been in the region since the beginning of the Cold War, 1947. I see it myself as a positive thing. That this particular book really is an empirical examination of American foreign policy. The reason why I think the end of America's hegemony in the Middle East is a good thing, because finally Arabs and Middle Easterners are taking charge of their own destiny. What we have seen in the last 15 months, the reason why I believe that America's decline does not just have to do with economic decline. It does not just have to do with the 9/11 wars that exacted a heavy toll on America's moral standing and image in the world. It has to do with the fact you have an awakened public opinion in that part of the world that's taking charge of their own destiny. And the focus is on empowerment, on basically being in charge of their own destiny. That's not the question, absolutely correct. What we're saying is that on the most important fundamental question, in which he himself defined, he has not really taken the leadership. He has not really stood up and basically tried. Let me give you an idea and be blunt what I mean by that. I mean, three major confrontation with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Three major confrontation, and rightly so. Barack Obama caved in the three confrontations.
With
why?
Netanyahu, yeah.
Why? Because, first of all, he did not want to challenge the Congress and special interest groups that would have required major investment. And also, President Barack Obama governs by consensus. When he faces challenges, he retreats. So we give him credit for a great deal things, in particular by getting the United States out of the ditch in which the neoconservatives basically put the United States in the first place. We believe that this president could be a great president in foreign policy. Unfortunately, so far, the president has not really basically translated his great promises into concrete policies.
Fawaz Jurjez. His new book is Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. It is quite a compelling read. Fawaz, Professor Jurjez, thank you so much. And anytime, we love having you here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And by the way, what say you? Jump in online at hereandnow.org. Are you disappointed in President Obama's leadership, or are you relieved that America's moment in the region may be over? Let us know your thoughts. Hereandnow.org. U.S. taxpayers are on the hook for $3.7 million this year alone to cover the expenses of four former presidents. This does not include the cost of Secret Service protection. It does include an $85,000 phone bill for George W. Bush, $440,000 in rent for Bill Clinton. Congress approved these benefits after Harry Truman struggled financially after leaving office. But today, our two most recent former presidents are making millions of dollars on the speaking circuit. So Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah is co-sponsoring a bill that would cut off those taxpayer dollars to any former president making more than $400,000 a year. Congressman Chaffetz, were you inspired by those expenses?
Yeah, it just seems a bit much for presidents who are earning millions and millions of dollars. It just seemed a little bit excessive. Nobody wants to see our former presidents destitute, but if you're going to go out in the private sector, and hey, we applaud this, doesn't mean the taxpayer should be paying for your parking fees and reimbursing you for your mobile phone.
What are some of the other things that you're seeing on these expense lists?
Well, everything from the mailing expenses to their office supplies to personnel. I mean, there is a role for a former president, and under our bill, you're going to get a $200,000 a year pension no matter what you do, and up to $200,000 to pay for other expenses if you want to go, you know, fishing for the rest of your life in Utah or Montana or something.
So wait, let's stop there, because this other expenses is interesting. The itemized budgets for 2012 show the two Bushes, the father and son, spent the most on these so-called other services, $130,000 for George H.W. Bush, $177,000 for George W. Bush, and the amount they're asking for next year is even higher. These other services, do they have to itemize what those are?
We don't have exposure to that. There's another category out there called equipment. I don't know what this equipment is, but for Bush 43, for example, in 2011, that was $86,000. They have some legitimate expenses, but I, as a taxpayer, don't think I should be paying for that if he's going to go out and earn $15 million in the private sector.
Well, we're also wondering, too, what is the transparency on things we do understand, like phone bills? I don't understand how you can get an $85,000 phone bill, you know, but that's what George W. Bush has. And then Bill Clinton has the rental, and that's presumably for his office. He has the Clinton Foundation. They work on things like AIDS and obesity initiatives. I'm not assigning any blame here, but do we know if, for instance, some of those phone calls by George W. Bush could be for campaigns, or some of the work done in an office for Bill Clinton could be political?
Exactly. It's not as if they have a separate office that deals with just their business opportunities or their speaking arrangements, and then have everything else that's maybe philanthropic or has to do with some government work and maybe advising a current president. That's why this seems like a reasonable bill.
Well, devil's advocate here. Couldn't you say that they actually sacrificed for 4 or 8 years to receive the salary of a president, and now the money that they are getting from taxpayers, in effect their former employers, should be higher, because if it had been real employers in, let's say, the corporate world, their pensions would be in the millions?
Perhaps, but they did make a sacrifice. They were the president of the United States. And under the bill that we proposed with Jason Altmaier, a Democrat, our bill says forevermore you're going to get the equivalent in today's dollars of $200,000. That doesn't go away no matter what. We're just saying if you earn more than $400,000, then dollar for dollar we're going to reduce that $200,000 allowance that we give you to operate your office down to zero if you're going to go out and make millions.
That's Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah, who's proposing a bill to end taxpayer-funded expenses for living presidents making more than $400,000 a year. That would be his suggestion. And by the way, we here in Massachusetts are aware that you have an interesting family relation, that you are the half-brother of John Dukakis, who is the adopted son of Michael Dukakis, the former presidential candidate here from Massachusetts, and someone who's very much on the left. You're considered, you know, pretty much on the right. Would you do us a favor and come back someday? And, you know, we'd love to talk about how does that go, you know, at big family reunions.
That would be great, because we are polar opposites politically, but very close as brothers. And it is an interesting story, and I'd love to chat with you about it.
Congressman Chaffetz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There was shock and sadness when former All-Pro linebacker Junior Seau committed suicide on May 2nd. He was just 43. And our next guest also expressed regret. He's Sports Illustrated senior writer Peter King, who covered Seau's 20-year NFL career, and he now joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Peter, regret. Why?
Well, because I'm part of the hype machine, and so many of us wrote factually, but perhaps embellished a bit too much about how Junior Seau was a Superman-type figure. Never got hurt. I mean, I watched him be an absolutely dominant player in a game in Buffalo one time when Seau had a legitimately torn hamstring. Mm. So once you start to tell somebody, which we told America over and over again, that Junior Seau was this superior being who played through the kind of pain that would put people out for 6 weeks, you just start to question after his career what happens when Superman needs help.
Well, and you say further, you and other sports writers made it impossible for him to seek help, even, you know, when he was playing and he was hurt. If his legacy, if his heroism is that he plays in pain, then he has to play in pain.
During the 14 years of his prime, before he really literally just broke down, in those 14 years, he only missed 9 games. And, you know, Robin, he played like the Tasmanian devil. He just was unstoppable. He was Pete Rose in a football uniform. You always watched him and say, how can he play at that speed for an entire game, especially when he had some legitimate injuries? And I don't know how much of a factor that was in his post-career life, because I'm not sure that being Superman and not being able to ask for help is the reason why he did this. I think in the past few weeks, some other factors have come out. His business investments appeared to be in great financial distress. But I'm just saying that for my part, I'm going to think hard again before I place somebody else in a stratosphere above human.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, we don't know what happened to Junior Seau, but you seem to be saying that players that were lionized for not talking about physical pain, then when they were in retirement, you know, wouldn't even have the skills to talk about emotional pain if it was there. And you put some of your writing in the article. You mentioned that hamstring injury. And, you know, even in writing about it, it makes me feel uncomfortable, you know, because, you know, you think about what a hamstring, how that feels. And you wrote about how he was playing with this torn hamstring. And here's some of your writing. This was an injury that would sideline most players for 2 weeks, trainer James Collins had thought after examining Seau in St. Louis. But as he left the team plane upon arrival in San Diego, Seau said to Collins, "See you at 5:30. Sure enough, 7 hours later, Seau was there. Mythic writing about the playing.
I have to tell you, Robin, he's not alone. I'll never forget there was a New York Giants quarterback named Kent Graham who, it was a bad Giants team in 1998, and we in the press just treated Kent Graham like Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin or something after that game, because he turns out he played that game with a severe concussion, half the time didn't know where he was, and he ended up taking a bad Giants team and beating a 13-0 Denver Broncos team. And so Kent Graham was basically held up on America's shoulders for doing something so brave, when in reality, what we know now is that that really isn't smart.
Well, you know what I'm wondering, Peter? What are you hearing from other sports writers? You know, Joe Drape is a great friend of this program. He's the king of horse race riding, and he's been reexamining that sport, even though he loves it, you know, taking a closer look at maybe what he didn't want to see about how the horses were treated. Here you are doing this soul searching. Are you hearing from other sports writers saying, yeah, come to think of it, why are we applauding playing in pain?
I haven't, but I definitely am going to raise this topic this summer when I go out to 20 to 25 NFL training camps. I think it's important for us to write considering the fact that our words sometimes can carry tremendous weight. As I look back on that story on Seau and on other stories I've done, I think that I'm going to now ask the question every time I'm with one of these players, why are you doing this? You could be hurting yourself permanently. They're going to say whatever they're going to say, but I think that I'm going to be less in a position to basically turn guys into these heroic figures. I think it's unrealistic for us to expect our sports heroes to not feel pain.
Well, and you do know what they're going to say because you have an exchange with Junior Seau in your article when he said to you, the corporate game, the media game, we have to play that game, but the game I'm playing is the one about respect. You earn it between the lines. And he got all choked up, and he said, finally, it's about courage.
Robin, there was a scene that I didn't write about, but I'll never forget it. One of the assistant coaches on the team came up to Seau while he was getting what he called his broke hamstring treated after the game, and he just gave him a huge hug and said to him, you're a warrior, man. And Seau just nodded, and the guy went away, and he basically said, that's what I'm playing for. There are a lot of guys who are like Seau who, hey, they like the money. They like taking care of their families and all that. But there's a warrior ethos that I totally agree with you. That's not going to go away.
But it sounds like you're saying, instead of saying you're a warrior, you want to say you're injured, you know? And,
yeah.
And it takes a lot of courage to admit that sometimes.
So many players feel like if I let my backup play and he plays well, I might not get my job back, number one. Number two, I'm going to get the reputation that I won't sell out for the team. And that's a whole big issue in and of itself that I believe is at the core of why we see so many debilitating injuries and why we see so many NFL players suffering long-term after their careers are over. I just think the lesson that I've learned in the last few years is be careful about lionizing players for playing with injuries that nobody should play with. I think the more logical way to look at it is, dude, get to the sidelines. Somebody else is going to have to play.
Peter King, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, talking about his own soul searching after the suicide of Junior Seau. His article is entitled Playing in Pain, All Men Are Mortal. Peter, thanks so much.
All right, Robin, thank you.
Of the great waters, constantly in motion, the wind blows through Sinesco and today.
Musician Rob Morsberger has been busy. A new CD, Ghosts Before Breakfast. He also performs on the new CDs from Loudon Wainwright III and Patti Smith. And he won a Grammy for his soundtrack work on HBO's Boardwalk Empire. Rob Morsberger is also getting ready for a concert near his home in New York with Brad Roberts of the Crash Test Dummies. They've been working on a song cycle called Midnight Garden.
Did you ever think to wander at the roots down underground? Miles of highways in the soil, unseen for miles around.
Rob Morsberger's been busy. So how did he find the time to join us from the NPR studios in New York? Rob, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. So glad to be back.
You were with us a couple years ago, and at that time you had a lot of irons in the fire, but now you're like a blacksmith. you're doing so much. And so we have to ask, we were wondering if, you know, some of your recent medical news is propelling you.
As you obviously know, I unexpectedly was diagnosed in September with a terminal brain cancer. And so, you know, when you have an illness like that, for anybody, you sort of reprioritize how you want to spend your time. You don't know how much there is. And in my case, it certainly made me want to focus on record making and songwriting.
Gee, what happened? We want to move on. Hear some of this great music. But we heard you had terrible headaches, went to the hospital. And oh, yes, there's, you know, stage 4 cancerous tumor. Now, it has been removed, right?
Yeah. Actually, just to be factually correct, it's not stage 4, it's a grade 4 glioblastoma. That means that's just the worst, most aggressive form that particular tumor manifests. And, you know, the doctors, they have their statistics and their median survival, and it's not that great. But I kind of like to think that somehow I'm going to exceed what they're giving me.
And you feel good, right?
I was back in the studio 2 days after surgery working on Ghost Before Breakfast. And for the most part, in the intervening months, I've felt great.
Well, and so we're going with that for the next few minutes. Okay. Let's listen to a little of the title song from Ghost Before Breakfast.
Hello.
You wrote this before your illness?
Yeah, actually Hans Richter wrote those lyrics about 90 years before my illness, because those were his words. That chorus, "Hello everybody, there's no time for tears, baby, it's a new life every day." Each one of those lines is a title of a film that he created. And I just stitched together, kind of like I did with the Dalton Trumbo song that we talked about last time, where I was incorporating actual works into the lyrics.
Right, and that was on the CD where you made references to the blacklisted writer Dalton Trumbo. You also had a song, Old Jolly Farm, we just loved. It was about the three civil rights workers killed in Mississippi, Schwerner, Goodwin, and Cheney. And in this one, Ghost Before Breakfast, tell us more about those movie titles.
My friend Dave Davidson actually made the film to Old Jolly Farm for the last record, has been working on a documentary film called Everything Turns, Everything Revolves, about Hans Richter. And he's a wonderful artist who became, if not the first abstract filmmaker, one of the very first abstract filmmakers in the 20s. And that song was introduced to me by Dave, and he asked me to score it. So to actually write a rock and roll song to a silent film was really an interesting thing to do for me.
Well, but we expect nothing less from you. Interesting things. And there's another song on the CD that's based on the novelist Henry James' final words. Do I have that right?
Probably apocryphally, he is said to have, on his deathbed, uttered the words, "So here it is, the distinguished thing," meaning his death.
Well, of course I have to ask, was this something you put together before, again, your own illness, and you know, if so, was it something you wanted to jettison, or were drawn closer to?
All I can tell you is that, and there's even better examples of songs on the record that seem to be about this subject of mortality and so on.
And finding a tumor in your brain, let's just, you know.
And there
it
was.
Yeah, and there it was. Yep.
It was sort of provocative to be lying in a hospital bed in the middle of this record. I couldn't help thinking of certain songs in particular that just really seemed to be pointing to what ended up happening to me. You know, it's possible to make more of that than it really is, but, you know, but I think there was a little bit of intuitive, you know, something deep down in me kind of knew that this was coming, and it came out, I think, in some of the songs.
As they say, there's no coincidences. Well, let's listen to a little of The Distinguished Thing.
So here it is, The Distinguished Thing, the story of what is and what is not.
So, Rob Morseberger, kind of a jaunty tune.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I guess one thing I do is when you play that tune and in the context of the conversation, I mean, that song is a celebration. And this whole experience for me has been moving and compelling and good. So it's nice that that song kind of reflects that.
With so many stories left to tell, and so much that remains undone.
The one song on the record that sort of takes the dark view is Feather in a Stream. And that's sort of interesting, again, in the context of was I kind of aware of something subconsciously? I think I was, and you can see it most clearly in that, because that song, I had a very clear idea of what that song was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be about loss of control in a person's life, like you're a feather in a stream. And I realized immediately when I wrote those lyrics, I was writing about death, and my, specifically my death, took me by surprise. And that wasn't that long before I found myself in a hospital.
Wow. I was just kidding, God.
Yeah. Caught in the damnable of gravity, these hollowed bones cannot redeem. Time washes over me, and I am born just like a feather in a stream, side to side.
Rob Morseberger, his latest CD is Ghost Before Breakfast. Rob, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.